Well, the doors are being shut, so I presume that's the appointed minute to start. Hello, everybody. My name's Greg Martin. I'm chairing this session, which is Risk Management, Common Sense or Rocket Science by Jenny Sparks. So if it doesn't sound familiar what you thought you were here for, you better have another look. Jenny will give you some more instructions in a minute around exactly how she wants to run the session, but I'll just introduce Jenny at the moment and then we'll sort of go to the usual sort of Q&A at the end or comments as the case may be. For people, some of you in the room would probably know Jenny, I'm sure. She's been around for quite a while. I won't say exactly how many 30 years. But she's been in Japan for 16 years and finally found it back to Australia, but I understand she's probably going back to Japan. So Jenny's currently the President and CEO of Hartford Life in Japan. She was previously the Chief Financial Officer and Risk Officer there from 2011 and was appointed CEO more recently, about this time last year. She's had a range of roles in Japan, including senior roles with GE ERC, CFO and CRO at Manulife, CFO for AIG in Japan. There's also other roles as well. So I won't go into the whole thing. We'll be here for an hour and a half. But she, of course, was in Australia before all that, where she was working for places such as AMP. So I'll just hand over to Jenny, and if you would mind welcoming her to the stage. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Let me start with a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I'm not an expert on risk management and I don't have all the answers. So if you come to this session because you think you're going to get the answers, this is not the right session to be in. Secondly, I'm not a consultant, as you can tell from the plainness of the slides. No graphics, no pictures, just words. The intention of the slides were that people could just take them away and hopefully use them, particularly the last two slides. Also, if you thought risk and thought Japan and thought general insurance and you're going to get some comments about tsunamis and earthquakes, I'm on the life side, not the gen side, so you won't be hearing anything about that. So with all of those disclaimers, let me tell you what I am going to talk about and why. I have had a fair bit of experience managing risk in a practical sense. I'm here mainly because I was asked, and I felt that I've come to so many of these presentations and listened, and it was about time I contributed. And I'm also here because I'm concerned that risk management has become too theoretical. I'm hoping that by sharing my experiences, this session may help you to apply risk management better in practice. As I prepared this session, I've actually learnt a lot, both by reading papers and by seeking input from others. So today, certainly if you have questions at the end, feel free to ask those. But what I'd like to hear from you is some of your experiences, as that'll help me learn, as well as the rest of you. So for me, risk management is quite basic. What can go wrong, and what do you do about it? I know we're meant to be looking at the good side and how can you leverage it, but largely for me, it's about what can go wrong. At Manulife Japan, we had a pretty basic approach. Once a month, the senior team would get together. We would discuss the risks, and we'd pull together a monthly risk report. Through that discussion, we clarified the risks, we made sure we were all on the same page, and we agreed on the actions we would take. Conversely, at AIG, we talked a lot about economic capital, risk appetites, and risk profiles. However, in my 7 years at AIG, I cannot recall before 2008 ever having a discussion about what really were the risks in the organisation. The factor that humbled AIG was not that they didn't have their economic capital model. It was that they took their eye off the ball and weren't watching the risks. Hartford Japan, as many of you may know, is a run-off variable annuity company. In many ways, our risks are very different to the other companies in the industry. And yet our regulator expects Hartford to follow the same risk management approach as all the other companies. My concern there is it means that we're not focusing on what the risks are for our company. Risk management has become increasingly sophisticated. The science of risk management is very important and relevant, but we should not exclusively rely on the numbers. My concern is that if we become too focused on the complex side of risk management, we may in fact fail to take action to manage the core risks. I'm also concerned about the focus on monitoring rather than managing, the drive for a standard approach, and the disempowerment of the rank and file if risk management is seen to be a black box. Before presenting, I was a little worried that my ideas might be outliers and might alienate a lot of people, so I decided to do a survey. Now, I biased the survey pool a little in that I chose 20 of my former colleagues and my current colleagues, many of them who are actuaries. So the comments I'm sharing today are an amalgam of my views and the views expressed in response to that survey. So first of all, if I can get this to turn, risk culture. So why is risk culture important? As the first two quotes here show, effective risk management is more about the people and their attitudes than it is about the framework and the systems. So it's very important to have the right culture. Risks are inherent in all aspects of the business. It is simply impossible for one person, the chief risk officer, or one small group of people, the risk department, to be aware of all of the risks all of the time. So it's imperative that every person in the organisation accept that risk management is their responsibility. Hartford Japan is now a relatively small company of 170 people in runoff and with a single product line. As firstly CRO and then CEO, I decided that for our company, it was preferable not to establish a risk management department. Instead, for each type of risk, we assign a department as having the responsibility for monitoring the risk, for establishing or putting forward the ideas for the policies about that risk, and providing recommendations for managing the risk. But it is the Enterprise Risk Management Department that coordinates risk management and finally makes the decisions about actions to take. The eight members of the senior management team are the members of the Enterprise Risk Management Committee. Feeding into that committee, we have two risk subcommittees, one for financial risk and one for non-financial risk. The members of those subcommittees are all of the next layer down of management. I believe that our structure has helped create an environment where the majority of staff do accept that risk management is everyone's responsibility. However, I have received a lot of criticism about that structure and ongoing questions of who really is the CRO. To me, risk culture is about three things: establishing an awareness of the need for risk management, develop the knowledge of the business itself, of the risk management framework, and of the actual risks facing the company. And then creating an attitude where everybody has the desire to actually get involved in managing the risks. So how do you actually build a risk culture? Well, all survey respondents were in agreement with myself that risk culture is absolutely critical, but building a risk culture is very, very hard. The points on this page provide some guidelines on how to establish a risk culture. They are not listed in any priority order, and I don't intend to talk to all of them. So have a quick look, and then I'll focus on some of the key ones. Without a doubt, risk management needs to be driven from the top, from the board and the CEO. This means being passionate about risk management and speaking about it constantly. But words aren't enough, as you hear time and time again. You must walk the talk. Well, I'm pretty passionate about risk management, and most people say I talk a lot. I know as CEO I need to do this, but I'm always wondering whether I'm actually getting through, whether people are hearing my message. One thing is very, very clear. I need to keep it simple, and I need to work with the team to take action. Another point I'd like to highlight is the one about when things go wrong. It's very hard not to go off the deep end when things go badly wrong. However, if you get upset with the person who provides the bad news, or if you punish the person who makes the mistake rather than treating it as a learning opportunity, you will encourage bad news to be hidden and risk to be overlooked. I've certainly seen that in practice. In one of the companies in which I worked, I very much admired the CEO, except for one thing. As a Japanese CEO, he believed that the minute somebody got something wrong, they should be punished. That included docking salary. First time it happened to me, I was pretty upset. And I said to him, well, there's a strong incentive not to bring these sort of things to you in future. We never reached agreement on that, but I believe it's very important. If someone intentionally breaks the rules or repeatedly makes the same mistake, of course punish them. On the opposite side of punishment, rewarding. So rewarding the right behaviour, I believe everyone agrees, is the right thing to do. Establishing appropriate compensation systems is often cited as the way you do that. But in my experience, building an appropriate performance-based compensation system is difficult and time-consuming. So by all means, start work on this. But in my mind, it is not the immediate priority. I've certainly found that a simple thank you or praising people in front of their peers has a very positive impact. To the last point, above all, keep in mind that this is not once and done. Building and maintaining a risk culture is a continuous activity. And I'm sure I'm not teaching any of you anything new by saying that. Risk appetite. And here we did get a divergence of views amongst the survey responses. One of the issues with risk appetite is that it means very different things to different people. My views on the importance of risk appetite were certainly tainted by my time at ARG. Much time was spent defining it at a macro level, but as history has shown, at the end of the day, defining the risk appetite was meaningless. It was all about, or should have all been about, managing the risk and being aware of the risks that existed. So in the past, I interpreted risk appetite as a set of numerical measures, and I've not always found defining appetite for risk in numerical terms to be necessary or important. And as I was leading up to this presentation, speaking to my appointed actuary, he said, well, we can't do anything because we don't have a risk appetite statement. And he said this actually many times over the last 2 years. My response was, we know what our risks are, we know what we're doing about it. But to him, it was very important to have it defined. So what happened when I did the survey? Well, the majority of survey respondents believe it is very important to have a risk appetite statement. Some of that may be the APRA influence. A number expressed their view on the reason for its importance as a clear guide for strategic decisions. Setting a common risk language and as a major component in building a risk culture. Through the preparation for this presentation, I have come to have a broader interpretation of risk appetite and a better appreciation of why it's important. And I may start work on defining a risk appetite statement. I think to start with, in defining a risk appetite statement, probably the most important thing is that you do actually think about what risks you are exposed to and whether those risks are acceptable to the company or not. In setting the limit or extent to which risk is acceptable, it's critical that the measures be relevant and understandable. If it's hard to come up with a quantitative measure, then start with a simple qualitative one and refine it over time. As one of the survey respondents put it, the key thing is to find a way to define whether the level of risk is increasing or decreasing, and a key point, whether it's a problem or not. Highlight the point about zero tolerance, because I went on to ask people, how do you define your tolerance for operational risk? And some said, well, zero tolerance. You often hear about reputation risk. We have zero tolerance. But you can't have a business without some level of operational risk. So specifying zero tolerance is not realistic. Risk appetite needs to guide strategy, and strategy needs to guide your risk appetite. So it's very much a chicken and egg situation, therefore pointing to the need for an iterative cycle. The degree of formality and comprehensiveness of the approach will be dependent on the company's size, the company's situation, and the risk management maturity. If you're not ready for something complex, start simple and work from there. Furthermore, a frequent review is necessary as the company's situation and the external environment change. Though many people don't like to hear it, the world does not stand still, and you need to change with it. Now, you all wanted to know why I'm referring to rocket science. Well, what this question on common sense or rocket science really means is questioning the need for complexity versus simplicity, the need for quantitative measures versus qualitative, and the balance between a technical approach and a practical one. I do think that people become scared when they hear all the terminology and see the complex quantitative and technical aspects of risk management. I know I do. I've been very pleased to see that there are a number of sessions at this particular summit that focus more on the practical. There have been many sessions I attended where I really struggled to understand the content. The issue is that in consequence, people tend to ignore even the more basic aspects, or they decide that risk management is only for the professionals. When this happens, the business people shy away from taking responsibility for managing the risk. Models definitely can add value. However, they need to be fit for purpose. We often have very bright people working in risk management areas who may build more sophisticated models than are necessary because they can and because they like the mental challenge of doing that. There are times when that is necessary. However, the sophisticated model is often too costly, too time-consuming, and doesn't produce the results in a timely fashion when you can act upon them. And as I've already mentioned, people may disregard the results if they think they're coming out of a black box. Also, I found in many companies there's a lot of focus about measuring the risk. Certainly, it's still the situation in my company. So in discussions, you say, OK, you've measured the risk and this is the current status, but what are you going to do about it? Or if it's currently in a green status, well, what do we do about it when we get to a red status? And they don't know. With a run-off annuity business that went through 2008, most of our risk, at least in a financial sense, was already incurred. But at the requirement of the regulator and our parent, we measure it all the time. But we're not actually going to take action. The more that organisations can make risk management practical and meaningful for all the staff, the more likely they will be able to build a sound risk culture and make risk management effective. However, while common sense is always necessary, it can only take you so far. A very important aspect of models is not only do they assist in measuring the risk now, but they do allow scenario testing, thereby providing an understanding of how sensitive is the measure to various drivers. On the counter side, rocket science is only useful if it's tempered by judgment and is part of a practical hands-on framework. So to sum up, I believe that risk management is a balance between common sense or judgment and rocket science, in other words, the models. The survey participants were unanimous on that point. I also in the survey asked a number of detailed questions that I've not specifically addressed in these slides. These questions included, is it necessary to have a risk management department? What should be the respective roles of the risk management committee, the risk management department, and the business departments? And what role should the regulator play? However, as I pulled together this presentation, I realised that the answers to many of the questions is that it depends, which leads to the topic of this slide. Does one standard risk management approach suit all companies? I believe that the answer to this question is an emphatic no. And on reading many papers on risk management, that seems to be a common view. However, many are critical that the regulators and rating agencies are driving a common approach, and in so doing, reducing risk management to a box-ticking exercise. I was careful to make sure that the quote I've used here was from the New York Times and doesn't refer to the Australian regulator. However, I do think this view is quite a prevailing view around the world. To me, in Japan, it's certainly a frustration. We have a very prescriptive regulator. There are risk management guidelines that are applicable to all insurance companies, and in an inspection, you do have to get ticked off in all of the boxes. And as I've said before, I believe that my company is somewhat different and it's not necessarily applicable. At least not all the points are applicable. A concern expressed by one of my colleagues is that an overly top-down risk management approach for a given industry can create a risk of its own. Risks may tend to naturally cluster in areas viewed by the herd as low risk, with potentially ironic consequence. A similar view was expressed in the New York Times article, which I've quoted here, primarily in regard to the banking industry. I believe that there is general agreement, both by business and the regulators, that regulators should set minimum acceptable standards while allowing significant flexibility to companies in how they implement, taking into account each company's unique circumstances. However, there is plenty of debate about how you define the word minimum. This will remain a challenge for regulators and for business for a long time to come. With regard to the last point on the slide, there are many pros and cons about having a risk management department. I have chosen not to create one in my company, but I agree that my approach would be unlikely to work in a large company with a wider suite of protection products, or maybe a wider suite of investment products, but as I say, I'm single line. The key to success of any framework is to provide clarity of roles and a strong risk culture so that the business departments and individual staff do not abdicate their risk management responsibility. I think it is useful to occasionally sit back and question yourself on what are the most important tools for risk management, and then check that your own company does in fact utilise these. Let me pause while you review the ones on the slide. Maybe there are things on there that you wouldn't have called tools. But I suggest there would be few, if any, who would contend that the first six items on this list are not important to risk management. It was actually surprising the number of people who indicated a good brain, by which I interpret it to mean common sense. It was not surprising the point that open communication was one of those top tools. Views were certainly divided as to whether a clearly defined risk appetite statement makes it onto this list. Some would say that it's implicit within the 6-point on framework and does not warrant inclusion in its own right. Others strongly argued that it is so important that it needs to be independently listed. If I had to highlight just one on this list that I think is critical but which may be overlooked, it is the open communication. I think it was in the very first session of this summit, first or second, that somebody mentioned the importance of asking the silly questions. No one wants to look silly, but it's certainly important to ask those questions. You're going, well, it sounds a little bit silly, but I really think I need to know the answer. Surprising the number of times people don't raise those questions, and they are very important. As I mentioned, the key risk management tool used at Manulife Japan was the monthly risk report. It wasn't the report that was important, it was the open discussion that led to the report. Open communication builds awareness of risks, both what they are and how to manage them. On the next two slides, I will talk about do's and don'ts, but a number of these relate to communication. Communicate early and often. Ensure that bad news is communicated as fast or faster than good news. And avoid groupthink by encouraging everyone to freely and honestly share their opinions. A good piece of advice that I received is to look very carefully at impactful decisions made with no dissent. And this is something that is pretty common in Japan. It suggests that only one frame of reference has been considered, or perhaps that people just haven't felt able to share their views. But at that point, should consider whether there is a need to bring in some different parties with different viewpoints to review the decision. As I considered what to say in this presentation, I felt that the most useful information to assist in the practical implementation of risk management might be a list of key do's and don'ts. So in many ways, these last two slides provide a summary of the whole presentation. Key focus on the do side is the focus on action. Do something and do it now. So just like the Nike logo, just do it. Understand that risk management is not the same as risk measurement. Only measure those things on which you plan to take action. Keep it simple, make it everyone's business, communicate openly, and think creatively. On the don't side, it would have been very easy just to put the opposite of the do's. I have tried not to repeat the ones that I mentioned under do's. So don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. Don't wait until you have the perfect solution. Focus on the big picture. And above all, don't forget the people are key. Put bluntly, good people can make even poor processes work. But poor people will mess up the best of processes. Even worse, unscrupulous people will manage to find a way to subvert any system or process. So to close, let me paraphrase what has been often written in articles, said in presentations, and reiterated in my survey responses. This may sound simple, but I'm sure as all of you know, it isn't. However, I hasten to add that failure is not an option. Good risk management is critical. So most of this is pretty basic. You've probably thought about it before, you may have heard it all before, but I'm just hoping that it's brought it back to the front of your minds. Also, being very selfish, I hope that some of you will come up and share comments about what you've found to work, what you haven't found to work. If you disagree, I like that. But more comments, opinions, more so than questions. Because I mentioned right at the beginning, I don't have the answers. Thank you.
At least spilt the water everywhere.
Sit down, stand up.
Why don't you sit down, Jenny? I'll pass the mic over. So if you've got questions, comments, observations, this is a practical session, so no circles, arrows, clouds with things coming out of them. It's all practical stuff, observations on anything that Jenny said. Over to you guys.
So I thought I would just share a couple of risk management experiences. I found that all very useful. One is a non-financial services story. This is from my husband's work as a technician in a defence science organisation, being checked up by the RHNS, who he was so annoyed with the way they approached the whole exercise that he left a, and I won't use the right technical term, a live electrical thing on his workbench that would have killed anyone who touched it. And the OHMS people came in and pulled him up because he had a doormat at his front door that someone could trip on, and he didn't have the right chair with the correct number of legs or something. And I think that the lesson from that is the idea that you really only can have people in effective risk management who understand the business, which is that reminder about having the integration of risk management into the business, whether it's the people running the business at the same time is a challenge that you raised, and maybe depends on the size of the organisation. But attracting people who actually know the business in depth into the risk management function and making it seem appealing and worthwhile to them can be quite a challenge. And the other one is about not measuring what you don't intend to actually act on. So I used to get very frustrated when we had sort of endless rules about all the things that had to be done and so on, but there was no actual checking on lots of them. And so this sends like completely the wrong message to people, because the people who do the right thing have wasted their time, and the people who do the wrong thing experience no negative consequences. So it's a very poor message. And I think that reinforces your message about zero tolerance. What does it actually mean? If it's just lip service and there's no consequences, then people will quickly lose respect for the entire process and framework.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for that, Bridget. There was a comment made by many people about you need to see the wood, not the trees. And I think that's what your first point mentioned. Focus on the big picture. But also very much a comment I didn't highlight, but I think has come out from your point, is if you do have a clearly defined risk appetite statement and you do have clearly defined risk tolerances, there's been questions in other seminars about, well, what do you do if something goes outside those limits? And the importance of actually stepping in and taking action when that happens, rather than just saying, well, let's move the boundaries. I think that's an important point as well as the one about reviewing it. But don't review it just because you've gone outside the boundaries.
Anybody else? Just while you're thinking, Jenny, you talked a lot about, or you mentioned risk culture quite a bit, and I know risk culture has been mentioned quite a bit in the last 2 days. I sort of wonder about risk culture, or rather just culture, and how important just culture is, because I don't quite understand heavy risk culture if you don't have a good culture in the first place
If you don't have good, if you have a good culture, how you have a bad risk culture. Are there any comments on that?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, you need to have a good culture, as you say. You need to have integrity. But when I talk about risk culture, it's about having that risk awareness in addition to having the integrity and doing the right thing.
Michael. By the way, everyone, you all remember the drill to make sure you say your name and all that sort of stuff?
Okay. Michael R. from the Phoenix Group in the UK. Sorry about that.
A bit of risk management.
That was a poor bit of risk management, wasn't it? Is that okay? Yep, good. A couple of comments I'd like to make. One of them was that you said that you should perhaps beware of decisions made with no dissent. But perhaps, and that presumably is because there's the probability of groupthink and people just haven't thought through all the issues. But what happens where you have a decision that is made, you know, by a majority where there really is very strong dissent and that dissent does have a valid basis? I mean, presumably there's a risk there that something will go wrong. I think I can recall a chairman of a large UK company making a comment that their board would never be comfortable making a decision that wasn't unanimous. But the important thing was that if somebody had a strong reason for objecting to something, then they would thoroughly thrash it out. And either everyone else would manage to convince the dissenter that it was reasonable, or presumably they would end up having to modify the decision or just not go ahead with the thing at all because the dissenter could convince other people that his or her sort of objections were valid. And so that you really, I suppose, that's a culture thing, I suppose, where people have to know what they're talking about and have to respect other people's opinions and be prepared to be convinced that someone else may have a better view on something than they do.
Very important point. Now, I often say that not making a decision is actually making a decision in itself. And that can be one of the most dangerous things you can do, is not actually making a decision. So you shouldn't be looking to get unanimous if people aren't unanimous. But finding it easy to make a decision because there hasn't been any dissent is not necessarily the right thing either. If there hasn't been any dissent, it's important to ask people, have they thoroughly thought it through? And as I say, sometimes to bring in people who come from a different background or who have a different perspective on it. But at the end of the day, a decision has to be made. And as people so often say, with the CEO, that's where the buck stops and you just have to make a call, having listened to all the opinions.
Can I ask a follow-on question? I wonder if... I seem to recall reading somewhere years ago that somebody described the corporate structure diagram of the ill-fated Bond Corporation as looking rather like the wiring diagram of a Boeing 747. And I wonder if... There are organisations that are probably just too complicated ever really to be manageable and for people to understand all the risks in them and whether, you know, what should be done about it? I mean, should some of these hideously complicated sort of banking conglomerates and so on be broken up because they probably aren't really manageable because of all the peculiar risks and interactions within the group and between the group and the rest of the economy?
I think an example there that I'd point to from my own experience is the one of AIG. I didn't attend Shauna's presentation, I guess because I lived through it all. But that's an interesting case study where a CEO, very brilliant man, did understand everything that was going on in the company. But at the end of the day, the biggest risk was probably not training its successor, or possibly a couple of successors. And when you bring in a new person, just being unable, probably any one person would have been unable to have that view across the breadth of the organisation. So that may be one example where it was just too complicated. Or to put it another way, if you're going to have a company of that sort of size, thinking through the structure such that you don't put people in a position where they're extended beyond their capabilities.
Anybody else? Here we go.
Hi, it's Jonathan Sheed. I just thought I'd share one grassroots story from our organisation that was kind of interesting and scary, because your comment about a risk culture needing to permeate permeate a firm, I think, is critical. When we were thinking about fraud risk, we actually got together a group of employees from various levels and said, all right, if you had to devise a scheme to rip this firm off, what would you do? That was very interesting. I wonder if you have any other thoughts about how you might get the frontline part of your firm, the claims administrator, the person actually reconciling trades in the back office. How do you get a risk culture to permeate down to that level?
That's a tough one, because we don't have many claims in a way, being an annuity company. Having said that, there are large amounts of money, so I take that comment back and say, yes, there is a possibility there of defrauding. It's probably one I haven't given enough thought to. And partly that's driven by being in the Japan environment. You do become somewhat complacent, I think, that by and large it's a pretty ethical culture. And secondly, they don't tend to... Where you do have indications of fraud, it's normally at the agent level, and they tend to defraud for very small amounts of money for some reason. I think my main response is I need to go away and think about that one more.
I can make a couple of comments on that, because it's something we've been doing at my firm more recently. I think you might be sitting next to she who does a lot of it. and that was... not fraud, but I meant the risk culture at the front, at the coalface. And the whole thing about getting risk culture down to the coalface is, you know, we've done quite a bit of work within small teams within our group, actually just getting them in a room to stare out the window, talk about risks, think about risks, try and think about what the controls are, judge their own controls, rate them and do all that sort of stuff. And you keep doing that sort of stuff and you keep talking about it. And it goes back to culture. If they see that it's regarded as important stuff within the business and it's an open culture, it's quite amazing how fast people will pick up that thinking about this stuff is important and actually volunteer things to you. Out of our area, I know there were certain bits where you'd never hear boo from them. And now, you know, I all the time they're bowling me up on all sorts of things in my company. So it's just, a lot of it is combining the culture with the, you know, walking the talk, and that's actually doing these things and actually taking the time and actually having someone senior, like, you know, CEO or immediate report, actually attending those things as well, so it's actually clear, right? You can't run these culture type sessions or risk workshops and then the senior people not turn up. That just screams a big message. It's all form, it's not substance. So you've got to do it.
Yeah, I was just going to say one further point on that is overall, too much reliance on compliance and checks. Often the response to uncovering a problem is to put in another layer of checking, and clearly the points you're making, Greg, are far more important than another layer of checks, which never works.
Alex?
Alex Ted. Look, a very quick and probably silly point against how quickly you can get a culture in place. It can also fall apart very quickly, especially when you get, say, a change in CEO and they start thinking differently. I'm not thinking risk as such, but I've seen organisations where the culture just fell apart very, very fast.
I suspect that was the bell, so I suspect we've got one or two comments left, if that's right. So, Glenn?
Glenn Langton. This is a question, a sort of an ignorant question. I know that in the investment area, that one of the problems I have is that people mean different things by risk. I'm interested in your comment on what we talk about, a risk appetite. I know I look after a superannuation fund where we've had to have a risk management statement, and there the risk is assessed in the impact on members' account balance, you know, the assets in the fund. If risk is measured by the impact on shareholder value, that is, you know, sort of, how do you actually measure, you know, the risk in terms of determining what your appetite is and what the implications of certain things happening?
It's part of the reason I did this presentation is because, as I mentioned right at the beginning, I'm more saying, what can go wrong and what do I do about it? I think as you start to think through these questions about risk appetite, you can tie yourself up in knots. And when that happens, you've got to go back to basics and say, what's going to really scare me? What's going to scare my parent company? What's going to scare the shareholders? And to some extent, how far can that go? And as I said, that may be by something very, very simple. It says, well, I can accept virtually none of this, or I can accept a fair bit of that, and over time you work out what almost none means and what a fair bit means. I do get concerned that we try and answer the questions you're raising and in the meantime forget to look at what's really important.
If I can just make an observation on that, Michael, from my perspective, I think, yeah, I think Jenny mentioned about the iteration between risk appetite and strategy and what comes first and all that sort of stuff. I think from my perspective, if you actually just sort of take a step up and think about what the objective is. So I think in your superannuation fund, the question is, what are you trying to do? If you're trying to deliver, you know, X outcome for members and you're trying to achieve these things, that is the thing you're aiming for, so not achieving that is your risk. And that's the way I tend to think about it. You then design your strategy to say, well, how do I maximise the chances of achieving that and minimise the chances I don't? And that's your risk management sort of. So, yeah, I find it interesting because in a life insurance environment, you know, one of the things I keep asking is, you know, my little company that I work for, you know, are we actually a wholesale owner of insurance risk? Is that what we're doing? That's what we pool and make money out of? Or are we actually a service company? You know, what will maximise value for a shareholder? And depending on how you answer that, you can get completely different answers around do we or don't we retain risk, the insurance risk. Yeah, interesting. Probably one more question or comment. Going, gone. Well, thank you very much, everybody. Please remember to do the online questionnaire, or what do you call it, rating of the session. And in the at the stage, if you just join with me and thank Jenny for her presentation and leading the speech. Thank you. Thank you.